Almost everybody over the age of 65 has at least one chronic condition, and usually two or three. And the longer your lifespan, the more you can anticipate some kind of chronic condition. And what characterizes a chronic condition is that you cannot expect to be cured from it, and therefore there is a limit to what medicine can do. And it means that the spiritual dimension, which has to do with how you cope with that, becomes very, very important living with chronic illness. So Esther is going to start off today with the medical side of this thing and talking about chronic illness. And then we'll move into the more spiritual aspects of coping with that. So Esther.
So what I'm going to cover, I'm going to first say what is chronic illness, some of its characteristics, and then some common chronic conditions, and then problems of living with a chronic illness. So some of this I've put on the board. First of all, I have what chronic illness is. And it's a term that's used to describe illnesses that include one or more of the following conditions. You might have permanent impairment or deviations. An example of this that comes to my mind is cancer. And of course, all of you can think of other conditions that will fit in this particular category and these various different categories. But for me, the one that immediately comes to my mind is cancer, because you're almost always going to have some kind of permanent impairment. Say, for instance, you have a cancer in your leg. Then there's going to be an amputation, and that's an impairment. And it also can be described as a deviation. Okay, secondly, there might be some residual physical or cognitive disability. And the example that immediately comes to my mind is a stroke. You can have both. You can have both your physical and your cognitive disability. Physical, again, I think very often you've seen the person that limps, and then usually, again, it's the left side. Doesn't have to be, but very often it's the left side. They will limp, and then you'll also see the limp arm. And then as far as the cognitive disability, they may have difficulty expressing themselves. Maybe their thinking isn't impaired necessarily, but again, there's that difficulty of saying what they really would like to say. Okay, then there might be some non-reversible pathological change. And here I'm thinking of something that probably most of us in this room have, which is some kind of degenerative arthritis of the spine. Again, in my work that I've been doing now, I deal a lot with whiplash injuries. And one of the things that I've discovered as I've studied whiplash injuries, that by the time you're 65, about 90% of people have some kind of osteoarthritis of the spine. Now, some people have symptoms. They have pain or some other indication that there's difficulty there. Others may not have any symptoms, but you still have the degenerative condition in your spine. Special rehabilitation. Again, my thought goes to the person that has had a heart condition and maybe has had a heart attack. There is definitely very special rehabilitation that goes on after a heart attack. Again, the person may not look visibly changed, but there are things that do alter the lifestyle. And then lastly, long-term medical and or nursing management might be part of the definition. And here, the condition that came to my mind again was cancer. One of the things that we've heard of, or maybe some of you have experienced, is a hospice program. Again, very often certain kinds of cancer requires long-term nursing management. Okay, then I want to move on to Chronic diseases include all impairments or pathological deviation characterized by one of the following. So, again, with your chronic illness, you may have these various different things. And again, I'm going to use an example of stroke. When you look at a stroke, all of these apply. So the duration usually of a chronic illness is longer than 6 months. If, as you know, an acute illness, usually it comes quickly, if managed properly, will go away, is resolvable without complications. But a chronic illness, you figure the duration is going to be longer than 6 months. There probably will be some kind of residual disability. Again, thinking of the stroke, there almost always is something that remains that people realize that they've had a stroke. There's non-reversible pathological alteration as a cause. Again, with the stroke, the clot in the brain, it hasn't been reversed. Certainly some of the edema or that sort of thing has absolved, gone away, and you will have some improvement in your condition, but basically there's some pathological condition that has remained. Need for special training of the person in rehabilitation. Again, thinking of the stroke person, if they've had the kind of damage where they've become aphasic or can't speak, they have to go through speech therapy for months and months and months. If they've had a physical, if they've had some kind of physical problem, then again they have to go through rehabilitation to either walk again or how to feed themselves, how to clothe themselves. Have you ever tried to button a button with only one hand? It's very difficult. Okay, also need for special training of the person in rehabilitation. Again, with the stroke person, they may have to make certain adjustments, maybe use a cane, maybe they will get past that stage, but anyway, there's usually special training required. Expectation that a long period of supervision, observation, or care will be required. And I think, again, that is very clear that there may be times when you'll improve, but then in certain chronic conditions there are remissions. And then you will need to maybe start from scratch again and go through the whole rehabilitative process. Okay, some common chronic conditions are like coronary artery disease, cancer, arthritis, and spinal cord injuries. Now, what are some of the chronic conditions that I didn't mention that comes to your mind?
Emphysema.
Emphysema definitely is a chronic condition. Do you all know what emphysema is? Anybody not know what emphysema is? Okay, what are?
Macular degeneration.
Okay.
Irreversible. I have it.
Do you all know what macular degeneration is? Anybody not know? Okay. It's a change in the eye.
It's a growth that can't be taken off.
That causes visual difficulty.
Asthma.
Asthma? Absolutely. Any other conditions that come to mind?
Depression.
Okay.
Diabetes.
Definitely.
Parkinson's disease.
That's right. It surely does.
But psychologically, we have baton veterans, post-traumatic stress that will never leave us until the day we join the war. So that, you might say, is a good example, too, of the
actually,
you think of
the serviceman or wartime experience as post-traumatic distress syndrome, but you'd be surprised how many people that haven't gone to war that have the same thing.
Hypertension.
Oh, absolutely. Hypertension, that's one of the biggies.
Heart murmurs. What is a heart murmur?
Heart murmur? Absolutely. Okay. Some of the problems of living with a chronic illness, and I've got these listed over here. Managing crisis. Now, one of the problems with managing a crisis, say for instance you had a stroke, what happens? Somebody takes control. You had the stroke. You're there. You're suffering. And all of a sudden, Somebody else has to make decisions for you. Okay, secondly, the managing regime. Again, when you get to the hospital, who's in charge? Are you? Hardly. There's the doctor that's telling you what to do. There's a nurse telling you what to do. There's the aide telling you what to do. So again, these are some of the problems of living with this chronic illness. Controlling symptoms. One of the things that may need to happen is that you're going to have to discover your limitations and how are you going to deal with those limitations. And of course, I think we all know this one, even if it's not a chronic illness. Any treatment, any medical therapy is going to be very costly. And one of the things that many older people have been struggling with is how do you deal with the high cost of living with the medications that you have, with just the medical care that's required. So this certainly is a big item with a chronic illness. Managing the trajectory. Now that might not make sense, but that's coping with the pattern of your illness. Now some illnesses, you know, this is what's going to happen now, and then if I get to this point, this is what's going to happen, and then this is what's going to happen. And so you can sort of plan how you move along in that illness. Other illnesses, for example, multiple sclerosis, you don't know what's going to happen. Some people that have multiple sclerosis become incapacitated very quickly, and others, to look at them, you would hardly know that they have this illness. So it's, you have to learn, or you have to cope again with managing the trajectory. Then managing social isolation. What happens with a person that has a chronic illness, say you're in a wheelchair? Certainly getting around, in recent years, buildings now are required to have ramps or that sort of thing. It's becoming easier and easier for someone in a wheelchair to move around, but there still are places. And even here at Holden, I think there are a lot of things that are difficult for somebody in a wheelchair. So not only are you forced into some kind of isolation, but how does the average person regard a person in a wheelchair or with a crutch or certain other things? I mean, you pull away. They can't go up the mountain with me, so I'm just going to cut my relationship with them. Or they can't do this with me, so I'll find somebody else that can do it with me. So bit by bit, a person with a chronic illness that is relatively incapacitating, and maybe not so incapacitating, even the diabetic, they have to be concerned about, say they're going to take a trip into the mountains, that they've got enough insulin with them to cover the time that they're there, they've got enough food, or all this sort of thing, so that they can manage their chronic condition while they're off doing different things. And then, of course, normalizing. Anyone that has a chronic illness, you want to fit into society as much as possible. You want to be able to move around. You want to be able to go to the symphony. You want to be able to do what all the other people are doing. So you have to look at your situation and then see, how can I fit in here? What can I do in order to, or what adjustment can I make, or what kind of community resource do I need in order to continue living as normal a life as possible? Okay, now I've gone through the various different things that I've listed, and I'm sure there's some of you here in this room that do live with chronic illness, and so I would like to find out what some of the problems are that you've experienced that maybe I haven't mentioned, and even if I have mentioned them, how you've dealt with your chronic illness, if you're willing to share.
Well, side effects from medication that are worse than the original condition.
Okay. So you're on medication and you're having all kinds of side effects.
Side effects, I can't take the medication for arthritis.
Okay. Now automatically, when I think of medication that's being taken for arthritis is something that has aspirin in it, which causes all kinds of gastrointestinal difficulties, like bleeding, that sort of thing. And so people that are taking large doses of aspirin very quickly either discover they can tolerate it or discover they can't because they begin to have all of these gastrointestinal difficulties. So yes, that can be a problem, just trying to find a medication that will give you some kind of comfort, okay?
There's a term that I find very helpful that's called iatrogenic illness. In other words, it's illness that's precipitated by whatever you're using as a remedy for the healing. Iatro means healing. And that's, I think, part of the problem, that what you do to try to deal at the physical level with the chronic illness can introduce things that that are sometimes as bad or worse than what you started with. Not all medical treatment is necessarily a good thing. That's why we are so committed to second opinions. You make very sure that what's being done is for your good.
Any others?
Esther, I never thought of my condition as being chronic illness, but I think it probably is. Impaired hearing. Would you consider that?
Sure.
What do I do about it?
You've had it longer than 6 months, haven't you?
yes. What do I do about it? I listen harder. But seriously, it definitely has changed my lifestyle. I find that I avoid a party, for example. There's no point in going because I couldn't hear what anybody was saying unless I'm right next to the person there. So that whenever there are simultaneous noises, I have great difficulty hearing. But I've isolated myself more. Because it's embarrassing to other people as well as to me to be an annoyance when I have to keep saying that sort of thing. And I guess that I have tried to compensate for it by doing other things that are equally rewarding, such as my own interests, photography and reading and that sort of thing.
Have you tried a hearing aid?
Yes, and not much good at all, really. You know, we can cure bad eyesight, but we can't cure hearing. We can help this, but somebody with glasses can get 20/20 vision again. But no matter, the hearing aids can only alter it a little bit. We cannot make it as good as it used to be. And plus, I have tinnitus. Do you know what that is?
Mm-hmm.
And, so all of those things cooperate. But so I'm all right on one-to-one, but. And on a lecture, but on discussion. So I think isolation is mainly what I'm doing.
So do y'all know what he was talking about when he said tinnitus?
Well, explain it.
Ringing in the ears?
How many of you can hear this?
Oh, yeah.
I can't, because I hear that all the time. 24 hours a day, I hear a ringing louder than that.
No. So continuing with the hearing problem, and you say you isolate yourself, I think this is very true of a lot of people with hearing difficulties, and very often some people will just simply give up, that after a while it's just too much trouble to try to socialize, and bit by bit they become loners. They stay to themselves. They actually remove themselves from society because it's just too difficult to cope with that hearing problem. And I see this happen very often. The older one gets, the more isolated they become.
And then you scare me?
My father's trajectory was that hearing problem, and I'm already aware that I have
I'm easily distracted, and so I share. I don't know. I'm fortunate to be a psychotherapist, so I can close the door, and I can ask the hairdresser next door to kind of turn his nose down and do a lot of things to really eliminate distractions, but it tends to isolate increasingly.
Now, I speak, my mother was this way. I mean, this is what she did. When she became hard of hearing, she just more or less isolated herself. But it's again like some of the other things we've talked about this week. If you desire not to become isolated, you won't be isolated. But if you choose to become isolated, it's one of those things that you have to make the adjustments that's going to work for you.
Hearing aids. I've been working with hearing aids for 3 years, and I have two of them now. Really, they're so frustrating that you don't know just what to do. I've been in here now for 3-4 days, and I almost always miss everything that's said from the audience. If you don't repeat it, or if the speaker doesn't repeat it or put it on the board, I do not have it. So therefore, I'm not in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I have very little hearing on my left ear, and I have loss of high notes in my right ear. It's just something that it's hard to work with. It's very hard to work with. I've had 4 different hearing aids. And they're costly, and they don't. And you don't know for sure if they're really helping.
Well, I'd like to speak to Ronald Reagan and find out what it's like to have one of those implants. I've not met anyone with an implant.
Medical aids, hearing aids, they're big because that's what I need.
Uh-huh.
But the same company makes those little tiny ones, but they wouldn't help me at all.
I'd like to see somebody with an implant. There are implants that are available, but they're very costly. And the only person that I know for sure that has one is Ronald Reagan, and the chances of my asking him how...
Are you sure it's an implant?
Yes.
Notice how nice and loud he talks.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I cannot hear when almost any of you talk.
Have you been able to hear me?
Yes, I can hear the speaker.
Some people.
I don't think I have anything to help Roman and Les a lot, but in North Idaho, where we live, over probably 60-70% of the men wear hearing aids because they were loggers and sawmill workers, and they never used earplugs. And I would just say that I know it's still an impairment. But I have a couple friends who have learned, along with hearing, to really look and lip read. And they zero in on a one-to-one conversation. And when I go visit Bert once a month, we sit so we can see each other and have no problem. He came and had a horseback ride with me, and I'm so stiff in my neck I couldn't turn to see him. So I had to shout the whole while, and Elaine said that they heard us 2 miles away.
I'm interested in the health factor of the resilience of families who have to be the environment for these long-term illnesses. I think that has a lot to do with how people are able to cope with their illnesses, how resilient their family systems are, and making those adaptations and structural shifts.
I think we'll get into that.
Could you say a little bit more about that? Because
can
I know
you say it a little louder.
Yeah, he's talking about the resilience of families that have to deal with the situation where there's chronic illness in the family. And I know you work with families a lot. I just wondered if you could say what you've observed.
Well, if I could use my mother as an example, I hope that's okay. My dad's hearing, just to stay on track with that, got worse and worse. He was able to do less and less socializing. My mother had to make a choice, because she's such a social person, to stay with my dad or be alone, isolated in a room with him. And that was a difficult struggle, I think, for her. And it was my sister who lived there who worked at a church that kept getting mom out to go to meetings and to meet people to balance her need for social normalcy so she could continue to sustain the resources to her husband as he moved toward death. In that particular family situation, there was a lot of talk about that and deliberate self-conscious work at arranging different resources for different levels of the family to do that kind of resiliency.
Yeah.
But I think if families don't have that kind of good communication, they become more rigid, they become quickly alienated, conflict surfaces and challenges all of their inner coping skills. Mm-hmm. And then things just go worse.
So it sounds like we're sort of ready to move on into the coping tasks of the chronically ill, but before we do that, I wanted to give you some statistics. Chronic disease is America's primary health problem. Approximately 50% of the population, 110 million people, have one or more chronic illness, and nearly 32.4 million people have limitations in performing self-care activities. So that's a lot of people. So anyone else want to bring up a chronic illness?
My husband has emphysema, and he's in the last stages of it, and he has crippling arthritis, and he's only 60 years old, and he has withdrawn from everything and everybody.
So if he has chronic emphysema, he probably needs oxygen regularly.
Yeah.
So does he take a portable tank with him, or doesn't he leave the house?
He doesn't go far. He just is withdrawn from the room.
I think pain is the ultimate isolator, too, because when I was 4 years old, my father's chronic thing started, and he passed away about 2 years ago. And he had a good deal of really difficult things to live with, and because that's all I ever knew, we were flexible and it worked well. We handled one thing, and then when something new came up, we handled that, you know, it's that kind of thing. But the pain, and that's the ultimate isolator, because if you can't manage that, you do totally keep to yourself. And the emphysema was really hard, and the liver cancer, and good deal other things. But that was really hard. He was bedridden about a year before mm-hmm. he did die.
Yeah, Tom has a good friend who has a chronic back problem, and pain limits him terribly. He can't go anywhere where he needs to sit for any period of time. That if he has to sit for several hours, he just can't go. So that, you know, very often he can go to a restaurant if he's not going to be there too long. That eliminates maybe symphonies, and he's in his 50s. So it's very limiting for him. Any other?
Okay, maybe you could put that list of coping things that you had as kind of background for this. I want to focus our attention more on the spiritual resources that people draw on for coping with chronic illness, since we're talking about spirituality and health. And I think that here is a place where you have perhaps the best example of the limits of modern medical care. And the fact that medicine goes no further than a case history. Now, you all know what a case history is, that some people complain that their physicians don't listen to them. But they listen very carefully for what they're trained to listen to. In other words, they want to know what the symptoms of the illness are. They want to know all the things that would give them a clue as to what's going on within the biological organism that is your body. And they may not pay attention to much more than that, which they consider irrelevant, but they pay very close attention to that. And if the story of your illness is limited to something that the physician can do to reverse that course, then this works very well. For example, you may go, physician does a case history, and the physician says, you have a hiatus hernia, which means that a portion of your stomach is coming up through your diaphragm where the esophagus goes through to connect to your stomach. And though that may cause you some discomfort, it can be easily corrected and it will do you no harm. And immediately there is a sense of reassurance, and with some surgical manipulation, the story is ended. And that works very well within the more limited kind of diseases that we may have. But as soon as you deal with a chronic illness or some other devastating kind of thing that comes into your life, you need a bigger story than that. You need the story of the illness. And by the story of the illness, I mean where you fit into that story, how you understand yourself in relation to this condition, how you cope with it, and what the resources are that you draw on to enable you to live with it. And there are wonderful, wonderful stories that come from people who live with chronic illness. I taught a course at Valpo for nurses and pre-med students on spiritual needs in healthcare. And one of their assignments in that course was to interview somebody who had a chronic condition over a number of years. And they were simply to sit down and listen to the story these people told about their chronic illness and how they lived with it, and then to report back what they heard. Fascinating, powerful stories of faith that came from people who endured that kind of struggle and had to go deep down for resources within themselves and for resources of their faith to enable them to deal with that. And so that's what I want us to pay a little attention to. I want to give you a couple of examples of this. I want to give you a couple examples of two different illness narratives of famous people. One is John Donne, a great writer and poet. And the other is Cornelius Ryan, one of the best chroniclers of World War II, and the different ways in which they made sense and coped with their illness. Dunn's devotion upon emergent occasions has to be read within the context of the 17th century culture, when serious illness meant that one took to bed, waited for the disease to reach its climax, endured the critical days, and patiently endured a lengthy period of convalescence. The passivity with which the patient was expected to accept the will of God in the course of the disease stands in striking contrast to the description of Cornelius Ryan in A Private Battle, where the model is the war hero who fights valiantly to the end against great odds. Ryan, a famous journalist and historian of World War II, became ill with cancer when he was researching and writing A Bridge Too Far, an epic account of a famous battle toward the end of the war. His story, as told by himself and his wife in A Private Battle, is full of stoic courage as he fought to complete this project. done sees a close connection between the travel of the body and the travel of the soul. And Ryan, between illness and war. For Dunn, religion provides the way to understand the meaning of illness and the way to experience it. Ryan uses a metaphor of battle to understand the meaning of cancer, perceived by him and many in our culture as an alien intruder and silent destroyer. For Dunn, everything that happens to his body in the course of his illness has a counterpart in the life of the soul. His is a sacramental view of illness and healing. For Ryan, illness has no meaning other than that of evil, cancer with the face of a mass murderer. If you compare those two, I find myself more in tune with Dunn, because he draws on the same resources that I do in terms of the faith tradition of which I am a part. But if you read the stories of people who cope with cancer, it's Cornelius Ryan who is the one that most people would identify and see themselves in a battle with cancer, and perhaps use imagery of whatever kind of treatment they are receiving as doing battle with the cancer cells and so forth. So there are different stories, different images, different ways of understanding what's going on and what might be a resource to the help of resolving what that illness is. Illness is not something neutral. It's placed within the context of our self-understanding and the meaning that we make out of life. And most people don't get much help with the narratives of their illness and ways to understand it. I want to give you a contemporary example now, and then open this up for comments and discussion that you may have. The best contemporary story that I've read recently of what it means to struggle with illness is a book that I strongly recommend to you. It's Arthur Frank, and the title of the book is At the Will of the Body. Arthur Frank is a medical sociologist, and he, at about the age of, I think it was 39, had a heart attack, and then in the following year had discovered that he had testicular cancer. And so it was like one blow on top of another at a time of his life when he was least expecting to be dealing with illnesses of this dimension and this import. And he writes a wonderful account of this in the book At the Will of the Body. And I want to give you just a few quotes out of that to give you a feel for what the need is, I think, of people for a big enough story to help them cope with the illness. He says, the ill person actively tries to make sense of what is happening to her body. She tries to maintain a relationship between what is happening to her body and what is going on in the rest of her life. When a person becomes a patient, physicians take over her body, and their understanding of the body separates it from the rest of her life. Medicine's understanding of pain, for instance, has little to do with the ill person's experience. For the person, pain is about incoherence and the disruption of relations with other people and things. It's about losing one sense of place and finding another. Medicine cannot enter into the experience. It seeks only cure or management. Now, Frank's book is about his effort to make some sense about what is happening to him in his own personal story, in his own personal journey. And one piece of that story, by no means all of it, comes with his identification with the Old Testament story of Jacob wrestling with an angel. And he puts it this way. He says, stories we tell ourselves about what is happening to us are dangerous because they are powerful. Stories come to us from many sources. Some we seek, many happen without our notice. Others impose themselves on our lives. We have to choose carefully which stories to live with, which to use to answer the question of what is happening to us. Jacob's wrestling became a story I lived with as a part of my personal mythology of illness. This is what it means to be ill, to wrestle through the long night, injured, and if you prevail until the sun rises, to receive a blessing. Through Jacob's story, illness becomes an adventure. I think that Frank has it right. We have to choose carefully the stories that we live with. And the story of Jacob wrestling with the angel is a powerful one. Certainly was for Frank. But even that story, I think, pales in comparison to the story of Jesus and his struggle through the long night of his suffering and death without a clear signal or awareness of how it would all come out. And then match that story with the resurrection and the dawn of a whole new beginning, which comes as a promise of God. That, for me and for most Christians, is the most powerful story that you have in terms of coping with the illness and the death and the resurrection that is almost always a part of every kind of illness narrative. What one is struggling with is to preserve not only one's life, but one's whole world. And the more disruptive the illness, the more likely is that to be the case. I want to give you just one other quote. That's from Luria's The Man with the Shattered World. And he says, why doesn't my memory function, my sight return? It's depressing having to start all over and make sense out of a world you've lost because of injury and illness, to get these bits and pieces to add up to a coherent whole. And I think that's the problem. Any major illness, any chronic illness, any catastrophe is like the shattering of a world. And then the question is, what brings some kind of sense of coherence back? What puts the bits and pieces back together? Maybe not physically, although putting it back together spiritually has effects that I think also are physical. But the question is, what brings a sense of coherence back into one's world again? That's what coping with chronic illness, I think, finally is all about. So I want to pause with that and invite your responses to that, men.
Yeah. I think myself and I'm, that your Ryan is not fair for him, because I think there are some people who are survivors. There are some people who challenge. Take it as a challenge to succeed and to improve themselves. We see examples of it all around. And I think that's the case. The VA many times make use of us ex-prisoners of war because of the challenges that we went through to assist the patients on different things.
Yeah.
And this sounds like bragging, but I think I can, myself, meet any challenges with the help of God.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't care. Any of those things that have happened to me in the past, I took them on as a challenge.
Yeah. That's very good, and I'm glad you said that, because all the literature on people, particularly who struggle with cancer, and you talk about their life expectancy, the patients who survive are the patients that are the kind that you're talking about, and for whom battle is perhaps the best metaphor for what they see themselves engaged in, and they all say the same thing, that the best cancer patient is the patient who is not the kind the medical establishment wants around. They're feisty. They fight for what they want. They don't simply accept what's given. They're the troublesome kind of patient, and they take it up as a challenge.
That's all we
know. He was kicked out of his ward in the hospital.
Yeah, right on. Okay, yeah.
I had some difficulty with the characterizing the feistiness to me, that which is, I of course agree, a primary contributor to your ability to succeed and survive a chronic illness. But those are characteristics of agency and assertiveness, that aggressiveness. And my problem is the way in which you tie that into your approach to spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have good words for why I'm struggling with that, but I think I go back to what I said yesterday about the inbreaking of grace through the realization of an immanent God as opposed to a transcendent God, questioning whether assertiveness gives you more of a picture of a transcendent God, one that is outside, one that you fight with. If you accept the inbreaking immanent God, does that make you passive and therefore unable to fight the battle against the chronic illness?
Ah, that's very interesting.
So I'm just struggling with what I had going on in my own mind. I think that they're different characteristics.
It would seem the opposite to me. That if I believe that I have all of the capacities of divine life without needing to call on the God from outside of myself, that would encourage me to go for it with all my ability.
Yeah, I agree with it. I think sometimes people characterize a transcendent God, though, as one outside from whom they actually have no inward agency, to whom they must, who is the all great being, and they are not an active agent of their own life, but must rely on the external force, mm-hmm. as opposed to the God who comes within that helps give them power within themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So you're right, if you have the concept of the immanent God as one who gives you power, then you have agency,
mm-hmm.
and you can fight. It's a question, I guess, really how you define transcendence and immanence.
Yeah, and when you define it the way you just did, then with the transcendent God, you're much more likely to be passive.
And yeah, that's true.
Which would have an analogy, analogously, it would be the patient who goes to the doctor and says, fix it. Mm-hmm. And where the doctor is that external agent who's going to make it better.
There's a, I don't know if I'm on the other side of that coin or not, but I was reading Carl Jung last night, who talks about the experience of profound healing is a passive act of yielding to the upswelling of the unconscious resources from within. That we can't will that or intend that or create that with tricky techniques, that it comes from a deep source within, and there's a passive quality to that.
Mm.
But I think there must be some active agency or assertiveness in releasing yourself into the passivity or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how we let go to create an inner openness to receive from both deep within and then connect to the outside. I think we're at that, some kind of trying to find the link between active, passive. And discussion.
Yeah, and that does become very, very complicated. But I think that's where the historic meditative, contemplative skills are enormously helpful for people who are able to do that.
You see that as an active agent?
Oh yes, it's both. It's active, but if you read the mystics, the active pursuit always ends up with a complete emptiness and receptivity from what comes from beyond. So it's always a combination, I think, of the two. Other comments about what happens? Yeah.
Having experienced environmental illness 12 years ago, I came to the end of myself, and I recognized everything on that chart, every step of the way. It drove me to God. I mean, I was totally, I could not depend on myself any longer. And it drove me to God, and there was no technique, nothing necessary, just seeking God and being in the Word, and I have to fight the spiritual battle every day to maintain this relationship with the Lord. And it has changed our lifestyle. We had to move from where we lived because of the chemicals there and because of pollution.
Yeah.
And my husband, little things like we couldn't use the electric blanket any longer because it throws off pollutants. So, and I can't even use a pillow and this, you know, and then water. I have to carry my own water wherever I go. So there are a lot of adjustments, but it's come into a good life now. It's developed into a good life, and we live in a place that is compatible to my health. And so my husband has had to make a lot of adjustments too.
Would you, I don't want to put you on the spot, but would you be willing to share a little of your experience with imagery that you started to tell me about and we haven't had a chance to?
Okay. When we came to the end of trying to get medical help, the doctor didn't know what was wrong, what to do for me. All medicines cause problems. And I had sort of a migraine type of situation where I was trembling and throbbing all the time. We went to a community college class on relaxation techniques, and my husband went along with it too. And we tried everything they taught us. He fell asleep, and then I went, and then I did the imagery. And that night I had the worst night of my life. There were all kinds of things went wrong, just everything. It was just unreal. And it took a few years before I found out that somehow I had allowed satanic influence to come into this. And I went through, some Christians prayed for me for days, and it was sort of an exorcism type of situation. And that, for the first time, I recognized that Satan can keep you sick, he can deceive you. So we have to recognize that the spiritual part of this is a very real part of it too. And we have to fight that spiritual battle, as in Ephesians 6:12, all the time.
Yeah.
And so it's changed, it's brought me closer to the Lord and very dependent on Him, just like a baby. I can't go a day without being in the Word and praying and just giving everything over to Him. And so it makes, so I don't, when you talk about imagery, I wonder how that differs from the experience I had, because it was not a Christian experience. And I have fear of it, you know, I want to stay away from that kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
I know that you're coming from
right.
a Christian point of view.
Right, my own understanding of that, I'm fascinated by your story and would love to know more about what kind of images you had and all that. But my understanding is that imagery or the use of the imagination is a neutral thing. I would call imagery visualization a psychotechnology, and it's a technique by which you get in touch with deeper than intellectual experiences within yourself. As such, I think it's a neutral thing. But what makes it linked to to faith, I think, and I'm using faith very broadly, is the content of the imagery. What are the images? In what direction are you led? And what's the context in which you're doing it? Is it a medical clinic? Is it the church? Or is it a satanic cult? I mean, all those are possible contexts. And I think as long as you use imagery that comes out of your faith tradition, for me as Christian, and you're doing it in the context of a community of other people who are supportive of that, that it's just a deeper than intellectual way to access your faith tradition, get beyond cognition to a deeper experience of it. And I've used that a lot, and I have yet to have anybody who has told me a story like you're telling me about the use of imagery and the way I've used it. And I'm not saying that to discount what happened to you, and if I were you, I would be scared to death of it as well. And what I like about what you shared is that it shows that when we talk about spirituality, we're talking about that which can be evil as well as that which is good. And you need to pay attention to the dimension of spirituality, which has the potential for great self-destructiveness. And we should not ignore that. Esther?
Yes. I was interested in what you were saying. I grew up, well, in my early teens, my father died and my mother became manic depressive. And sometimes she'd say to me, "Oh, Esther, it's just like the devil is pushing me to do some of these things." And I still have a question. Was it her illness, or is there such a thing as devils pushing, or Satan pushing us to do things? I have difficulty with that. And we studied Mark last week, and again about how he cast out the demons. And my question, I guess, would be about Mark, you know, what would be the Greek translation of demons, and is it really, you know, the what we think of as Satan, or what is it? I could not go along with my mother when she said, you know, the devil is pushing me to do this, and I felt it was her illness. Now, mm-hmm. I don't... And in your case, too, you know, you felt that Satan was pushing you to do that. Could it have been your illness?
No, I think Satan likes to tempt us to make us do things we're not supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I know sometimes when I'm trying to pray, he sticks his nose in and him and I go around and I tell him, "Get out of my way, Jesus Christ, my Savior." And I go back and forth with him, but he does try to tempt us into doing things that aren't what we believe in our Christian religion.
I want to give an opposite example of how imagery has helped me. I'm sure all of you at night sometimes you're lying there, your mind won't shut off, it just keeps going and going and going and going, and you know you've got to get some sleep. That's when I get out my little tape that says, you know, listen to the waters, or it's a tape that was put out by Don Tubesing. I don't know how many of you have heard him. And for me, then it cuts off. It helps me slow down my mind, and it helps me go to sleep when I need to go to sleep. Or it helps, I guess it relieves me of the stress. So it's the same sort of thing. It's very suggestive about, you know, the streams and a quiet place, and listen to your breathing. But for me, I found it exceedingly helpful. It works for me. And I even passed it on to a daughter when she was in college, and she was having some difficulties when exam time would come along, and then she would be all worked up. And I gave one of the tapes to her, and it's helped her as well. So it all depends on, I think, where you're coming from and sort of how it works for you.
Don Tubusing, by the way, is located in Duluth, Minnesota, is a head of Whole Person Associates. He's got three or four books in the bookstore, really good stuff in this whole area of spirituality and health and whole person health. Somebody else had a head up. Roman?
Recently, I suppose within the last 3 years, I've noticed a different behavior in myself. I've become very interested in the process of getting outside of myself and seeing myself from somewhere else. That I imagine myself to be somewhat like a leaf on a tree, not comparing them, but rather instead of just paying attention to me as me, I get my mind away from me and say, aren't those flowers interesting to look at and to watch? And isn't water or animals, that sort of thing. So I imagine, to the point where it seems almost totally real to me, that there's an interesting thing over there, watch it. So that I don't care about it so much in terms of emotion and problems that it might be having, but I simply say, I try to imagine that I'm the great mind of, or that I'm in touch with nature as a whole, as a universal thing, and say, it's fun to watch that. And I find that it's extremely enjoyable to see me struggling, or whatever, especially if I'm struggling or dealing with a problem that I might have. And I don't know if it might be aging or if it might be just, as I said, something about my hearing. But I just find that tremendously enriching. Am I making any sense?
If I can hazard a guess, you're describing self-hypnosis.
Oh, is that right?
You're really describing...
I don't think I'm hypnotizing
myself. No, you're describing the way you've learned automatically to go into a trance and distract your observing inner self and create a little bit of distance from your inner self to be able to be in the pure trance state. And that's a way of actually anesthetizing your pain.
I feel more what I'm doing is that I'm, for example, might be you. And just as you say, look at Roman. Isn't he interesting or humorous or pathetic to watch, say? I think of myself as being someone else who is being entertained, or if not entertained, at least informed or educated or delighted by the way that being operates. I feel that I am studying me from an unimpassioned distance. I'm getting an objective distance about myself, and I don't really care about myself then. Isn't that clear, I think?
That's a common, what you're describing, we commonly encourage people when they are trying to tell a difficult story, a story of a rape, or something that they cannot bring forth to, we encourage them to break themselves apart, to look into a movie screen and tell it like they're watching a picture, unimpassioned, objectively telling the story. So what I'm hearing you say is that you have a capability of dividing yourself, your consciousness, into two different levels,
mm-hmm.
so that you can look objectively at one. Does that sound more? And that's slightly different from self-induced hypnosis, but it's along the lines of a way of dividing your conscious so you have more than one, you're aware of more than one operating conscious level.
Roman, you've got two therapists on both sides that will get you through this problem, and the rest of us will go to lunch.